I said something on the tape before that was pointed out to me as being wrong, and I know the right answer, and I know that what made me do that. I kept saying that Dr. Jung was from Switzerland. He is not from Switzerland. He is from Sweden. He's from Switzerland. Why don't I guess it's a Freudian thing. That changes everything, right? He is from Switzerland. He is not from Sweden. Yeah, I think it was that blonde that wore a fire, but that's only not my intention. That's it, okay. We're going to do that again. And also, I just wanted to plug the OA birthday as long as I'm standing.
All right.
I've got a little bookmark here without the dates, but they have ones with the dates now. The OA birthday will be the last weekend of January next year, and that's going to be at the LAX Hilton. And the birthday is a great celebration. It's a wonderful opportunity to rekindle old friendships within the fellowship and to make new friendships, and it's really, really good. I love the OA birthday, and I always have, and I try to attend. And, it's just a wonderful, wonderful time. Yes, we definitely are. You've got to talk to John on that, though. Yes. We have been talking about the nature of the problem. We have talked about the fact that it is a problem of the mind and a problem of the body. That it is a problem of the mind insofar as the mind is seeking out a way to make itself feel better. When you cannot change seats, you're screwing me all up here. And the mind is looking for a way to make itself feel better. And that feeling of ease and comfort is called the effect. And that's what our brains are looking for. That when they're happy, when they're sad, when they're hurt, when they're guilty, when they're shamed, when they're angry, we seek out that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating the food. And that food does something for us that it does not do for the normal temperate eater. And that's called the effect. Unfortunately, once we eat the food, we also trigger the physical allergy. And the allergy makes it impossible for us to stop once we have started. And I can't eat because of the allergy, and I cannot keep from eating because of the twist of the mind, and I'm powerless over food. And we've talked this morning about Bill Wilson's story, and we talked about how the allergy of his body and the twist of his mind drove him irresistibly into the alcohol, and how his allergy made it impossible for him to stop once he had started, and how he had a spiritual experience. Not a spiritual awakening, but a spiritual experience, which is sudden and profound, that altered him to the point where he never found it necessary to drink ever again. Most of us will not have that kind of spiritual experience, and that's why in the 10th printing of the big book, in the first printing of the big book, they changed it. After the first printing, for the second printing, they changed it from spiritual experience to spiritual awakening, which is of the slower variety. There's the educational variety, which is hopefully what we're having this morning, hopefully what we're having this afternoon. We go to a meeting, we talk to somebody, that is of the educational variety. And the words in step 12 were changed from spiritual experience to spiritual awakening. There is a reward for that fly. If you can kill that little son of a bee, please do. Okay. We're not going to have the time to go through chapters 2, 3, and 4, but in chapters 2, 3, and 4, there is a wealth of information that I would suggest going through with your sponsor, with someone that knows the big book. Chapter 2 is vital, and it says, "We feel the elimination of drinking is but a beginning." And what that means is that is not a solution, it is a beginning. And it also says in there that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And when they say that the cessation of alcohol is but a beginning, what we're reminded of is if just going on a diet and losing weight were enough to cure us, then treatment centers, hospitals, Weight Watchers, Nutrisystems, bariatric surgeries would turn out winners, and they don't. They don't. Jails would turn out winners, and they don't. And it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. Is there anything I can do to alter the physical allergy? Absolutely not. But the only thing I can do is I can stop eating those allergic foods, but I can't do that on my own. So what we're going to do in steps 4 through 12, which are the action steps, is we're going to concentrate on the twist of the mind. And we're going to work these steps. We're going to hopefully have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And we will not find it necessary to eat ever again. Why is that? Because I will already feel better. We're also reminded that we have, in chapter 2, we're also reminded that we also have a mental blank spot. And what is the mental blank spot? The mental blank spot is the part of our brains which will prevent us from seeing, from remembering the devastation of the binge of an hour ago, a day ago, a week ago. Now, when all of us were babies, probably not quite 2 years old, we stuck our hand in something that was way, way, way too hot. And we burned ourselves. And we were crying, oh, were we crying, like bloody murder. In my case, I stuck my finger in a Sabbath candle because there was a bunch of the wax and I wanted to touch it to see what it felt like. And I stuck my finger in there, and this is a story I was told. I do not remember this, obviously, but it was a story that I was told. And, you know, I burned myself. Now, every time I have burned myself since that day, since that time, it was always by mistake. And the human brain is formed and functions in a way so as to protect you from danger and protect you from this pain. So if I came to your house with, say, $100 million in a bag, and I said to you, heat up your oven, and put your oven on 500 degrees, and we're going to run your oven for about an hour, and we're going to put a pot in there, an empty pot in the oven, and we're going to heat up this pot. And I said to you at the end of the hour, now hand me the pot without a kitchen mitt, without anything, just bare hands, hand me the pot. Your brain will not allow you to do that. Did you know that? Your brain will not allow you to grab that pot and grab onto it, even when I'm giving you $100 million to do so, because your brain in that area functions normally. But when it comes to food, it does not. And your brain will not recall that last binge or the devastation and the horror of that last binge. So we have no defense against it whatsoever. And we're shown in chapter 4 that the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. That's the thesis line in the book. The main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. Now notice it doesn't say problems plural. It says problems singular. Because when this is cleared up through the working of these steps, everything else gets a lot better very, very quickly. Everything else just improves in my life when I hold God's hand and I don't eat Kit Kat bars and I don't eat Almond Joys or Butterfinger bars. Okay? So everything gets better. And when I hold God's hand, I'm aware of the fact that He knows what He's doing. He knows how to run the universe. If I was supposed to be with that girl that just walked by here, I would be with that girl that just walked by here. You know why she walked by and I'm not with her? Because I'm not supposed to be. I live in Scottsdale, and the further north in Scottsdale you go, the more wealth you bump heads with. And there's Porsches and Rolls Royces and Ferraris and Maseratis. The further north in Scottsdale you go, the wealthier it gets. And I see these Maseratis and these Ferraris. If God wanted me driving one of those cars, I'd be driving one of those cars. I'm not driving it because I have a car that gets me where I want to go. And it's quite reliable. The main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. We also see in chapter 4 the phrase constant companionship with my Creator. Constant companionship. God is with me all the time. He's with me now. I prayed for guidance. Before I came in here, I went to the bathroom and I was asking God in my head, tell me what it is I'm supposed to say. Tell me what it is I'm supposed to do so I can serve you best. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. And that 10-step prayer is a prayer that goes with me all the time. Let's look at page 58 and let's take a look at, I wish we had the time for chapters 2, 3, and 4. Perhaps one day I'll come back here and we won't do Bill's story and we won't do the doctor's opinion. We'll just do 2, 3, and 4, and that would be an interesting retreat too. But we have to make sure that everybody came back and that there were no newcomers, so I didn't have to chew my cabbage twice. We would just continue on. Okay. How it works. Now I want you to listen to the patterns of language here and how absolute this language is and how clear Bill how clear God is going to be through Bill's hand. But before we begin, we're going to take a look at chapter 5. And I'm definitely doing something very wrong in this life. Very wrong. Anyway. The first four chapters. What?
I don't know who you can ask.
Yeah, I know. The first four. I need a graham cracker. And you never know what I'll do. Oh, that's why you wanted me to come. It wasn't for that. Okay. Oh, all right. Bill Wilson knew that the first four chapters were in the can, as they say, and he was quite nocturnal at this time in his life. And he was up at night, and he was laying in bed with his pencil and his pad. And he said that it was time, and he knew it was time, to outline the program of action. Because up till now, it's all been pretty theoretical. But he knew that it was time for him to outline the program of action. And he said in about 20 minutes, he wrote chapter 5. Now there was a bunch of changes that were forced on him through the fellowship. There were a lot of changes that were forced on him. But within about 20 minutes, he wrote chapter 5, which is one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature, inside one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen. And they did force some changes upon him. They made him take certain things out. They made him put certain things in. But the fight was on. And there was a lot of controversy within the fellowship about this chapter. When he began the chapter, there were 6 steps to the program. And when he finished the chapter, there were 12. Could you just imagine that we who are here in Costa Mesa, in Santa Barbara, California, had this retreat and all of a sudden decided that the OA program should be 24 steps, not 12. Could you just imagine the kind of fighting that would go on at the intergroups all over the world? You could just imagine that for yourself. And they fought. They fought, and his bill was kind of baffling and powerful too. And he says, look, either you finish the book or I'm going to finish the book. And he says, no, we want you to finish the book, but there are certain things we want you to do and not do. How it works. Page 58, rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly following our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Now, what is it that you're expected to be honest with yourself about at this point in the book? Is it that you're supposed to be honest with yourself that Springfield is the capital of Illinois and not Chicago? Is it that you're supposed to be honest with yourself that the Cubs really do suck? No, that's not what you're supposed to be honest with yourself about necessarily, although those are good things. But what you're supposed to be honest with yourself here is that you are a compulsive overeater and you are powerless over food. And that he has told you in these chapters repeatedly, because when the big book wants to tell you something, it doesn't just tell it to you once, it tells it to you many, many times in many, many different forms, because God understands the mind of an alcoholic compulsive overeater, that you don't just tell us something, but you have to tell us and tell us and tell us and tell us. that I have an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. That's what I must be honest with myself about. There was a reading this morning from chapter 3 that we are as men who have lost their legs, we will never grow new ones. I'm not going to wake up one day and be a normal eater. That's the great obsession of every compulsive overeater. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. There it is again. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. That's three times in one paragraph. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Here's what I call step zero. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. If you decide you want what we have, what is it that we have that you so seem to want? Is it that we're not eating or that we're losing weight? You can go to Weight Watchers and see people that are not eating or losing weight. You can go to the Bariatric Center and see people that are not eating or losing weight. You can go to the other pay and weight places out here in California or wherever it is you're from. We're from Arizona. But you don't have to come to OA to see that. But what you have in OA are people who are not compulsively overeating, and they are doing so happily. But they're not fighting food. They're not wrestling with food. They're not forcing themselves not to eat. It just comes naturally. Okay? And then it says, and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it. Are you? Because this is going to be referred to four times in the book. This is going to be referred to a lot in what we're going to read even today. You have to be willing to go to any way to get this. Then you are ready to take certain steps, but not until then. And some of these we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we couldn't. With all the earnestness at our command, we begged you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Now, there's going to be a couple of times here where he is going to remind us of something that the result was nil until we let go absolutely means that I get nothing until I do it 100%. When I wake up in the morning and I'm lucky enough to be alive, everything I do today, everything I say today, everything about me today is either going toward God or going toward the food, and there's no middle ground. There's no park. There's no neutral. You're either going toward God or going toward the food, and there's no middle ground. And that comes from anything and everything I do today. It comes from the way I greet you, and it speaks to the way I speak to you, and it speaks to my aura, and it speaks to my neshama. I'm going to teach you a Yiddish word. Neshama means your spirit, your holiness. If I have a neshama that is one of, I don't want to deal with you, I don't want to talk to you, I'm moving toward the food. If I have a neshama, a holiness, a spirit that moves me toward charitable work, that moves me toward caring and helping other people, I can't just care about them, I have to take action. Now I am moving toward God. I'm either moving toward God or I'm moving toward the food, and there is no middle ground. In keeping with that, the result was nil until we let go absolutely. I treat it as a vending machine. If the product in the vending machine costs $1 and you put in 99 cents, what do you get out? Nothing. You'd be lucky if you get your 99 cents back, right? I'm either in or I'm out. If you're going to work 3-4 steps, you hear people do the 1-2-3 waltz, they have a name for those people. They're called constant relapsers. They're called people that need a program. It's a 12-step program, not a 3-step program. Okay? Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. There was a sponsor and a sponsee going over this sentence, and the sponsee says, what's the most powerful, what's the most important word there? Is it cunning? And I said, I mean, the person said no. And they said, I believe you. The person said no. They said, then it's got to be powerful. And the person said no. And the sponsor finally said, the most important word in that sentence is, remember. Remember that we deal with food, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for that for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Now it's going to show us how to find God. Half measures availed us nothing. Once again, the result was nil until we let go absolutely. The half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Do you notice the language there? There's no ambiguity there. There's no wiggle room there. You're either in or you're out. Complete abandon. The result was nil. Half measures availed us nothing. Going to three meetings a week, calling in your food, and calling your sponsor is not working a program. Those are parts of working a program. I call my sponsor every day. Those are parts of working a program, but they are not working the steps. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We're not going to read them today. Let's go to page 263, and let's see where they come from. 263 in the fourth edition. Let's see where the steps come from. Let's see their origin, and how we got from 6 to 12 was he wanted to close the loopholes. Bill Wilson said many times he never set out to write 12 steps. He set out to close a bunch of loopholes that he looked at these alcoholics jumping through. Number one, complete deflation. Number two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. Number six, continued work with other alcoholics. And that was the six-step program that the alcoholics were working as they made the split between the Oxford group, which is this, what this is, and Alcoholics Anonymous. While they were the drunk squad of the Oxford group, this is the program that they were working. Go back to page 60, please. Many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, that's the doctor's opinion, chapter 1, Bill's story. Chapter 2, there is a solution, not one of many, but there is a solution. And chapter 3, more about alcoholism, goes back to that. The chapter to the agnostic, chapter 4, we agnostic. What is an agnostic? Ag means without, gnostic means knowledge. An agnostic is someone without knowledge. An atheist knows that there is no God, and a believer knows that there is a God, and an agnostic has no knowledge. Made clear three pertinent ideas. Now, you've heard these in all your meetings. You've heard the ABCs at all the meetings that you go to. Let's take them apart a little bit and let's see what they mean, and let's see if we can glean some more knowledge out of them. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Now, I say this a lot, but I have to. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person with a twist of the mind that drives them irresistibly into the food in search of an effect that the brain knows that the food will give that person. That sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating a Kit Kat or a Butterfinger or an Almond Joy bar. And what is an alcoholic? A person who has a physical allergy which would prevent them from controlling the amount of Kit Kat bars they eat once they've started, because in their body, once they eat these things, they cannot stop. So the more they want, the more they eat, the more they eat, the more they want, the more they want, the more they eat, the more they eat, the more to the chipmunks, because that's how fast I wish I could talk right now, because that's where we're going. And this is my whole life being that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And we think that if somebody would start doing this, or somebody would stop doing this, or somebody would this, or somebody would that, then my life would be fine. Or if I had money, or if I had sex, or if I had fame, or if I had fortune. I'm going to mention some names to you. You may not be old enough to remember all these people. If you're not, you can Google them. These people had it all, and they died in our disease. William Howard Taft was the president of the United States. He had to have a bathtub brought into the White House because he couldn't fit in the frickin' bathtub that they had in there before. Fatty Arbuckle, one of the greatest silent movie stars ever. Oliver Hardy, one of the greatest comedians of all time, died from our illness. Mama Cass Elliot, Karen Carpenter, John Candy, Chris Farley, John Belushi, Elvis Presley. Did I say Jackie Gleason? Jackie Gleason. Look at these people and more, and what do you see? You see people who had it all. You see people whose fame and fortune were second to none. Brilliant, brilliant people. Brilliant people. And they died from this illness. Mama Cass Elliot had the voice of an angel, as did Karen Carpenter. Mama Cass Elliot died in London. She was going on to perform at the London Palladium, and she was shoving a sandwich in her mouth, and she died at about 400 pounds. And my friend Sherry Belinsky, and my mother, and people that you love, people that you care about, people that were precious to you, that you buried from this illness, that seemingly had it all, but they could not stop eating because they have an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind that money would not buy them out of. Fame wouldn't buy them out of it. Fortune wouldn't buy them out of it. And they're dead way before their time because of an illness of the mind and an illness of the body. That God could and would if he were sought. But not if you have a God in your head that you're not willing to believe in. Not if you have a God in your head that you're afraid of. Not if you have a God in your head that you're at odds with. I must have a God in my head and in my heart and in my soul that I am willing to believe in. Being convinced we were at step three. Being convinced of what? Of all three of the things we've just talked about. If you're not convinced of them, it used to say in there, reread the book up to this point or simply throw it away. That was in the original manuscript of the book. Either reread the book to this point or simply throw it away. That we be convinced to turn our will and life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that and what do we do? Let's pull it apart just a little bit. What is my will and what is my life? Because there are people in the rooms of OA that don't know what that means. My will is my thinking. My life is my action. My will is my decision-making thinking. My life is my action. What do you know of me? You know of me what I do. You don't know what I am inside, but you know what I do. And that is my destiny. That is who I am. So what are we turning over? Our thoughts and our deeds over to His care and direction. The first requirement, notice the word requirement. It isn't a suggestion. It isn't a, well, it would be nice. It is a requirement that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. If you still have ideas on how you're going to live your life according to your will, you're wasting our time. You're wasting your time. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Now, we're defining in this paragraph the character defect that is most prevalent in every disturbance I'm going to have, and that is selfishness. Selfishness is that script that he's describing here that some people are just not going to stick to. And when they don't stick to my script, it really makes me mad. So let's take a look at this again and see where he's going with this selfishness. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest, but as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. So I may kick your ass to get my way, or I may kiss your ass to get my way, but one way or the other, I am trying to get you to do what it is I want you to do so that I think I can have a better life. Now we're going to go into the defect of self-seeking. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. And boy, we like to blame other people, don't we? There's four things all addicts like to do. And the addict will do these things as naturally as they breathe. We lie. We assign blame. We keep score in our relationships, and we fight battles that just don't exist. We love doing those four things. We lie, we assign blame, we keep score, and we fight battles that just don't exist. We do those things as naturally as we breathe. We love doing those things, don't we? And it just makes sense to us, because those other people are just stupid. They're just idiots. They just won't do what we want them to do. Perhaps they're whatever, you know, or they're not driving fast enough, you know, maybe that's the case. Okay. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants and do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? So the more I try to stick my nose in there and try to get my own way, the worse matters got. I am a fly in the spider web. The more I struggle and the more I pull, the tighter and tighter the web goes around me, and I am eventually going to be eaten by the spider. Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolled in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. That's a warning. I must be rid of the selfishness. Why must I be rid of my defects of character? Because I want to be this perfect person? Hardly. I'm never going to be rid of them. But selfishness, fear, anger, self-seeking, and dishonesty will trigger the mental twist. The mental twist drives me into the food. I eat the food in search of the effect. I trigger the allergy. I pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to eat that way again. And I will repeat that cycle over, 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 and over again. The mind telling me that the food makes perfect sense, and the body ensuring it indeed does not. Where am I? Oh, so our troubles? This is the how and the why. Thank you. This is the how and the why. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Now here are your third step promises, although it doesn't say so officially. These are your third step promises. When we sincerely took such a position, what position is that? The one described in the last paragraph, where he is the father, we are the children, he is the principal, we are the agents. That when we sincerely took such a position, top of 63, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, watch your capitals. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Now, in every sense that a human being can be reborn, and I'm not talking about born-again religion, I'm not saying that, but in every possible sense that a human being can be reborn, I have been reborn. I am not the person that I was on May 24, 1954. I am not the person that I was at age 10. I am not the person that I was at age 25 or 30. I am today an honest person. I am today a forthright person. I am today a person who looks to see what I can contribute to life, what I can do for the next compulsive overeater. In my life, before this, I was a taker. I was a taker. I would give you a dime, but I would be knocking on your door for a dollar, reminding you that I am giving you the dime. In my life before, I was a liar and a manipulator. In my life before, I was a very, very selfish, self-seeking, scared to death, angry, and dishonest person. Now, before we continue to the paragraph where the third step prayer is, let's briefly take a look at where fear and anger come from, and where selfishness and self-seeking and dishonesty come from. And that means that we're going to take a look at the emanation point of these various human defects of character. All human beings have emotions. Let's take a look at the three basic instincts of life. And let's take a look at when these basic instincts of life are threatened in the area of our ambitions for the future in these areas, or if when they are threatened in we feel somebody is going to take away what we already have in these areas, this is where fear comes from, and this is where anger comes from. The first of the basic instincts is the social instinct. Now, all instincts are given to us by God. They are imbued into our spirit so that we could live a better life. And the social instinct is something that God hardwired into us so that we could live more efficiently. Cro-Magnon man, Peking man, Heidelberg man, All the cavemen, all the cultures of cavemen knew, understood very well that they could live better by living in social groups. They could hunt more efficiently. They could fish more efficiently. They could protect themselves from invaders and from animals more efficiently if they worked together in groups. So this idea that we want to be accepted by the group and nurtured by the group is as old as time. And if you want to make somebody feel very bad, try to exclude them from the group. If you want a good lesson in the social instinct, go to any high school or middle school on Monday. You won't see a lot of discussions about math and science, but you'll see discussions about who sat with who at lunch, and who likes who, and who likes who, and who wants to kiss who. You'll see these various things in motion. Okay? So the basic instinct of the social instinct is hardwired into us by God. And if you want to see some of the headlines, or what's behind some of the headlines where these people are killing or they're doing whatever, what's one of the first things to go by the wayside? They had no friends, they knew no people, they were completely isolated. So the social instinct is a very important instinct, and it is hardwired into us by God. One of the subsets of the social instinct is self-esteem. Self-esteem is not usually what I think of me, but it is more a reflection on what I think you think of me. And when I think you think that I'm a pretty good egg, then I'll like me. When I think you don't think I'm a pretty good egg, I might not like me. But self-esteem is a very important part of the social instinct. So if you're upsetting my ambitions for the future in self-esteem, or you are upsetting what I currently think of myself, I am going to fear you. I'm going to become angry with you. I'm going to self-seek. I'm going to lie. I'm going to manipulate. I'm going to do what I need to do to get you to stop that behavior or start that behavior. Also, we have two other basic instincts. The first one of the two is the security instinct. And the security instinct is pocketbook, money, making a living. The security instinct is hardwired into us by God. And if we didn't have that security instinct, we wouldn't provide the food, the shelter, the clothing that we must provide for our families. I know that we're all in here to live one day at a time, but I hope I'm not the only person in this room that has a life insurance policy, even though my daughter doesn't speak to me. I have a life insurance policy so that I can provide for her something to start her life with were I to pass away. And I hope I'm not the only person in this room with something of a savings account so that if a rainy day does come, I'll have some way of hooking into that money to carry me through a rainy day. A couple of other parts of the security instinct. One is emotional security. If you upset my ambitions for the future in the area of emotional security, or what I currently have in emotional security, you're going to upset me. The other part of the security instinct is personal security. If somebody came in here to harm us physically, it would evoke fear in us, it would evoke anger in us, and we would protect ourselves, and that comes from the God-given security instinct. So in these two instincts, if you upset what I already have or my ambitions for the future, you're going to upset me. I'm going to strike out at you in anger. I'm going to strike out at you in self-seeking, fear, whatever it is I need to do. The third basic instinct of life is the sex instinct. The sex instinct is hardwired into us by God. And if you upset what I already have in the sex instinct or my ambitions for the future, it is going to upset me. If we didn't have this sex desire, if we didn't have this sex instinct, within about 100 to 120 years from right now, the world would not have any human beings left in it. About 100 to 120 years from now, there'd be bears and lions and more mosquitoes and flies and everything else just completely covering this area. There'd be no people here at all whatsoever. So these are things that are hardwired into us. And this is where anger comes from, and this is where fear comes from. And this is part of the stuff you don't hear enough of in OA. There's not enough sponsors in OA that make the connection between these things and a spiritual awakening and my intake of chocolate pudding. They just don't make that connection. And people drop out of OA never realizing why we're sitting here talking about God, and why we're sitting here talking about all these things that seemingly have nothing to do with their intake of food. And it has everything to do with their intake of food. It's just that we're not explaining it correctly. We're not taking the time to explain what these things have to do with our intake of food. Okay, page 63. We were now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, God, I offer my... Oh, if you're going to do step 4 through 12, you may say this with me. If you have no intention of doing those things, then don't. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me, and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life, and I do Thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, and we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. And there's that language again. No ambiguity. Now, if 4 is the most misunderstood step, and it's very simple, we're going to break it down, then 3 is the second most misunderstood step. What are you turning over in step 3? Nothing. Nothing. You're not turning anything over to God in step 3. You are deciding to do so. And step 3 is going to be called a decision and a beginning. And step 3 is just the formal terms of surrender. It means I have decided in the first 2 steps that I cannot do this, and I am making a decision to go ahead and do the rest of the steps. If there's 3 frogs, and they're sitting on a log, and one of the frogs makes a decision to jump off the log, how many frogs are on the log? 3. Because a mere decision to jump off the log will not get his butt off the log. You have to take action. Step 3, in and of itself, is useless unless you are going to do 4 through 12. And that's where a lot of people just misunderstand step 3. They think they're turning something over by uttering that prayer that we just said. You're turning nothing over, because the prayer itself says that you are going to ask God to take away your difficulties, that you're going to offer yourself to Thee. What does that mean? That means you're going to do steps 4 through 12. Okay. It says next. Oh, wait. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor, but it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional so long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning. Step 3 is a beginning and a decision. Though it honestly and humbly made an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Next, not in a year, not in a month, not in 6 months, says next. There's no reason to wait. And there are sponsors that tell people boogie mindset. Everybody know what a boogie mindset is? It's a Yiddish word. Boogie means grandmother, and a mindset is a story. It's a story my grandmother would have told me. It's a boogie mindset. You get right to work on step 4 right away. Right away. And you get on it. And some of the misconceptions about step 4 are, I want to do it perfectly, I want to be at the perfect weight, working the perfect program so I can do the perfect step 4. Nonsense. God is not going to hang your 4th step on His refrigerator. Just get right to it and do the work and do what you need to do, and don't worry about being perfect. Don't get an A on your 4th step. Go for a B minus. Go for a B, B minus, okay? Just do it. You don't have to be working the perfect program, have the perfect food plan, be at the perfect weight, have the perfect car and the perfect outfit. Just get to work on it. It's very, very simple. We're going to break it down. Next, we launched on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. which many of us had never attended, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it can have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. My overweight situation is a condition of an illness. It is not the illness in and of itself. And we talked about that before, that we go into the hospital, we go to Weight Watchers, we go to the bariatric center, and they see we're overweight. So they try to reduce the number of calories going in our mouth through your willpower, through my willpower. And that doesn't solve the problem. And the reason it doesn't solve the problem is it's not the problem. The weight is a symptom of an illness, and the illness is of the mind and the body. But when the spiritual malady is overcome, we're okay. Okay. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Now, before we begin with the resentments, let's look at what a resentment is, and let's look at why I hang on to resentments, and let's look at the payoff to a resentment. Why do I love a good resentment, and what is a resentment? Resentment comes from two old words. Re always means to do again. Repaint, refuel, rewrite, re-edit means to do again. Sentiment comes from an old word, sentire, which means to feel. So a resentment is to rehearse, replay an old feeling. And I have a resentment replay machine right here in my head. And every morning, I would get up and I would replay what that damn person did to me 20 years ago. I would replay what that damn God did to me 50 years ago. I would replay what that damn person did to me 47 years ago. I would replay what that person did to me yesterday. I would replay all these various things over and over and over and over again in my mind. And what happens is, I am not always honest with myself. Now, I happen to love the Chicago Bears. I love the Chicago Bears. And I have a CD at home that has on it the Super Bowl that the Bears won against the New England Patriots in January of 1986. Now, I played that when it was in VHS form many, many times. I could tell you every commercial. I could tell you every announcer's word. I could tell you what play was going to be read. I could tell you when they're going to call timeout. I could tell you who's going to score every time. I could tell you everything about that tape and that CD. Because you see, that CD has something I do not have. And that's called fidelity. Fidelity means honesty and consistency. Fidelity. But in my mind, when I have a resentment, I do not have fidelity. Because every single time I replay that resentment of what that person did to me yesterday, what that person did to me 40 years ago, 50 years ago, I change that just a little bit, and I make your part a little more dastardly, and my part just a little more innocent. And if you let me replay that thing over and over and over again in my mind, I was standing there and I was doing nothing, and you came along and you did me dirt. And in my mind, that just makes sense because I've replayed that so many times that it's just apparent to me that you're a schmo and I'm a good person and you came and hurt me. Okay? Resentment is the number one offender. Let's stay with page 64. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease. But we have not only... Oh, wait a minute. There's something I better mention or I'm going to kick myself for not mentioning it. Why do I love a good resentment? Well, the reason that I love a good resentment is if I can shift blame to you and abdicate responsibility for my life, and I can blame the Kit Kat bar I'm eating on Bob, and it was his fault in the first place, and if Bob hadn't treated me the way he treated me, I wouldn't be eating Kit Kat bars today. That's why I love a good resentment. It allows me to abdicate responsibility for my life. I no longer am responsible because I can shift the blame to another person. And that is the payoff to a good resentment. And that's why I love them so much. I love good resentment. But I also have a brain that gets sick in itself when I'm that resentful. And when I'm resentful like that, or I'm scared like that, God can't get in there. I've effectively blocked him out. And in blocking him out, I can now pick up the food because I'm operating on self-will. I'm not operating on God's will anymore. I'm operating on self-will. And as such, I am going to pick up the food. And I am going to eat the food. Okay. We did exactly the same thing with our lives, right? Is that what I mean? We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We're going to use four columns for the resentment section, four columns for the fear section, five columns for the sex section with a side assignment in the sex area. It's going to be that simple. And there's not one of you that doesn't know the answer to the four-step questions. There's not one of you that doesn't know. Column one, who or what do you resent? It's not always going to be a who. I always had a resentment against the old expression of blood is thicker than water. Because any time somebody said blood is thicker than water, it immediately left me out. I also had a resentment against people that used the term Nazi to describe things like, I've got a real Nazi sponsor. I've got a real Nazi for a teacher. No, no you don't. No, no. If you did, you'd be dead. No, you really don't. And I've had some of these things that have followed me through the years, and they are resentments, and they're not against people. So it's not always against a person. You also can have a resentment against the Chicago public school system. I was 335 pounds as a kid at Mather High School, and I couldn't fit in the desk, and I couldn't fit in my clothes, and I couldn't fit in my skin, and I couldn't fit in my life. And you know, there's counselors in the other room, and there's principals and assistant principals. You know that nobody ever tapped me on the shoulder and said, gosh, can I help you? Is there something we might be able to talk about? Is there something we might be able to do for you? There probably wasn't anything in this world that they could have done for me, but at least they could have showed me that they noticed me. At least they could have noticed I was the fattest kid in the school and that I was dying on the inside and wanted to die, period. And maybe they could have shown me a little bit of attention. Maybe they could have at least tried. It might have made a difference. So not all resentments are against people. Sometimes they're against principles. Sometimes they're against institutions. So the first column, we list resentment. In the resentment section, we list who or what do you resent? In the second column, what did they do to you in 19 words or less? The reason it's 19 words or less is we're going to get to the examples on the next page. We're only going to do the first two, but we're going to see that Bill never allows himself to use more than 19 words to describe any resentment that he has. Don't write me a book on why you resent Mr. Smith. Just 19 words or less. Just give me the headlines. Pretend you're USA Today. Just give me the headlines. Don't give me, you know, a whole big story. Okay? Third column. What part of self is affected? Is it the sex instinct, the social instinct, or the security instinct? Or is it several of them? A lot of times it's several of them. It's not just one. And in the fourth column, we'll get to on page 67. But for the first three columns, which is what we're dealing with right now, is who or what do you resent? What did they do to you in 19 words or less? What part of self is affected? That means your basic instinct. What basic instinct or instincts are affected by this resentment? Now, if you have questions on that, I'm not going to take them now, but write them down. This is very, very simple stuff. The worst thing you do is overthink it. Don't overthink any of it. Just do it. Okay. When the spiritual melodies are in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal relation, our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. Now, let's take a look at this resentment against Mr. Brown. And very quickly we see that we have this resentment, and we have actually several resentments against Mr. Brown. And usually the closer someone is to you, you will have resentments against them that number more than one. But in order to do this, what I just like to tell you is go through your life. It doesn't have to be perfect. Grammar school, high school, jobs, careers, church or synagogue. Camps, overnight camps, day camps, whatever jobs that you get, careers, college. Take a look at your life and these names will come back to you. What happens if you forget somebody? It's really okay as long as you're not doing it on purpose, because we have step 10. We have step 10 to kind of catch what you miss here. It's okay. They have a name for people that can't remember every intimate detail of their life. You know what they're called? Human beings, that's right. They're called human beings. And God understands that you are a human being. Okay. I'm resentful of Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife. Let's keep with that. That means it affects my sex relations, my self-esteem, fear. What's the fear here in this resentment against Mr. Brown and he's paying attention to my wife? And that is not just the fear that he's going to win my wife over. It's also fear that you may not think of. Fear of what is my family going to think of me if my wife runs off with Mr. Brown? What's her family going to think of me if my wife runs off to Mr. Brown? What's my boss going to think of me if my wife does that? What's going to happen to my money if she divorces me to run away with Brown? What's going to happen to my kids? What are they going to think of me if Mr. Brown is their new daddy? And these are the various ways that these fears, these angers, can go into your soul. It's not just as simple as, I don't want him paying attention to my wife. There's reasons why, and that is you don't want to give up your wife. You don't want to give up your money, your home. You want to keep your family intact. You want to, you know, have a loving nuclear family. Okay, Mr. Brown told my wife of my mistress. Oh, so Mr. Lucky Pants is all worried about Brown hitting on his wife, but Mr. Lucky Pants over there, he's got a mistress. So that's a little hypocritical there, but okay, let's stay with it. What does that affect? Sex relations, self-esteem, fear. What's the fear here? Same thing. What are my kids going to think if they find out I have a mistress? What's my family going to think? What's my boss going to think? These are the things that go through your mind. Brown may get my job at the office. No. Security, which is pocketbook, personal self-esteem, fear. What's my fear? fear is, if Brown gets my job at the office, maybe my wife will rethink my marriage. Maybe my parents will think I'm a schmo. Maybe her parents will think I'm a schmo. Maybe my kids will think I'm a schmo. And so, these fears and these emotions that run deep, they run complicated. But it's a very simple program of putting them down on paper so you can see it. And the three things that you'll do when you do this step is you'll uncover, discover, and discover. You'll uncover who you are. You'll discover what has been driving you, and you'll discard the garbage. Notice that there's nothing in here about character assets, and there's nothing in here about any of that other nonsense, narishkeit. Narishkeit is a Jewish word. Nar means fool. Narishkeit is foolishness. Narishkeit means foolishness. Okay? Let's do Mrs. Jones and then we'll move on. Mrs. Jones, she's a nut. She snubbed me. Well, that affects my personal relationship, self-esteem, fear. What's the fear here in Mrs. Jones snubbing him? What if she goes and tells his wife that he hit on her? What's going to happen then? What's going to happen to his family, his money? So you get the picture. A lot of it's very repetitive, but so is a lot of life. Okay, she committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. Well, if she committed her husband for drinking, and I'm an alcoholic, and she talks to my wife about committing her husband for drinking, maybe my wife's going to commit me for drinking, and I certainly don't want that. Okay, let's go to the bottom of 65. If you have questions about these things, write them down. When we do Q&A, you can ask them. Okay, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, what does harboring mean? To give them safe haven in our heads. We shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. With us to drink is to die. Why does having a resentment lead to the fruit? Why does having a resentment mean that I'm going to die? Because if I'm harboring a resentment, I am going to wake up the mental twist. The twist of the mind is going to drive me irresistibly into the food in search of the effect. I will eat the food in search of the effect. I will trigger the physical allergy. I will pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to eat the food again, and I will repeat that cycle over and over and over and over and over and over again, the mind telling me that the food makes perfect sense and the body ensuring that it does not. Now, I've repeated that a million times since I've been here. Because that is the cycle of death. And this is the machinery that the illness will use to kill you. This disease is mind over matter. It doesn't mind who it kills and you don't matter. It doesn't mind who it kills and you don't matter. You mean nothing. It will kill you, it will ransack your life and care nothing for you. It doesn't care how smart you are. It doesn't care how white you are, how black you are, how green you are, how orange you are. It doesn't care if you're Jew or Gentile, Catholic or Protestant, Buddhist or Shinto. It doesn't care whether you're a follower of the Muslim religion. It doesn't care what religion or what you are. It will take you and kill you and take you out. And this is how it kills. People are so good about their food, but they're not good about resentment. They're so good about their food, but they're not good about their fear. And we have a name for those people. They're called chronic relapsers. Because the mental twist is more strong, more powerful, and more cunning and baffling than your desire not to eat. Okay? When harboring such insanity of alcohol returns, we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. But if we die, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. The grouch is the person that's always in a bad mood, and the brainstorm is a person with a very explosive temper. I'm on page 66. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turned back to the list where it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancy or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. So in other words, a broken brain cannot fix my broken brain. I cannot will away these resentments. I must do what it says here in the book. Put them on paper and be prepared to let God have them. Now before we leave the resentment, or before we leave the page and go to the fourth column, there are people that are sitting here that may have some resentments that they are not sure they want to get rid of. Maybe some of you have been molested. Maybe some of you have been betrayed. Maybe some of you have been abandoned. Maybe some of you have had hurts from alcoholic parents or parents that were mentally ill or what have you. And you're thinking to yourself, you may not want to get rid of those resentments because you feel justified in having them. I remember I went to meetings in Skokie, Illinois with a lady. And her daughter fell in love with Mr. Wrong. And one day, Mr. Wrong came to her house and shot her daughter in the face. And killed her daughter. And I remember her coming back to meetings, white as a ghost. She looked like she had aged 150 years. She came back. This was a big headline in Chicago, going back now 35 years, when I first came in, 35 years ago. She said, "That son of a bitch took my daughter. And he's not going to get one more minute of my life. I'm going to continue to recover." Some of you have had horrible injustices done to you. I'm sorry. On behalf of the human race, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that that happened. Are you now ready to have God take these things from you so you can live free? Haven't you given these people enough of your life? Haven't you given these people enough decades of your life? You're going to live in hell so that they can win? The people that came to kill my family that night so long ago, I'm not giving them one more minute. I'm not giving them one more second. There are people in this room that have cried with tears incessantly over these injuries. The body shows the tears that the eyes refuse to shed. It's time to let it go. It's time to trust God and let them go. It's time to live the one life you have in freedom that you deserve. Some of those people do not even remember hurting you. And some of those people were doing the best they could. And some of those people, even if they meant to hurt you, they were sick too. And they were just as human as you were. And if it wouldn't have been you they did that to, it would have been someone else. But unfortunately, it was you. Let's let it go. Let's give God a chance. Let's put God to the test. I dare you. Give Him an opportunity to show Himself to you. Give Him an opportunity by trusting Him and letting Him do with your life as He will do, and a cessation of this internal pain will come. I promise you. I promise you. My father knew about that pain, and he wasn't going to let it go. And it took away whatever he might have been or had in the rest of his life. I loved him. He was my dad. And I know he loved me. But he was a tortured, tortured soul. He was a tortured, injured, broken soul, my father. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, here's your four-step prayer, your sick man prayer. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. There's your sick man prayer right there. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one of them. Now, here's your fourth column to your resentment section of your inventory. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongdoings, the wrongdoings others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Uh-oh, I've never done that before. I don't like looking at my part in things. I'd rather look at your part. I'd much rather pick up the magnifying glass than the mirror. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not entirely been our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. Column 4 in the resentment section. Based on the defects of character, what did you do or omit doing to cause the problem? And what character defects were brought to the surface? What did you do to set the ball in motion? And what character defects were brought to the surface? Okay. If you have questions on this, write them down. We'll go over them later. It's real simple. I didn't say anything here that is so esoteric that you do not know the answer. I didn't ask you to do anything here. The book doesn't ask you to do anything here. Not me. See, Michael? The book doesn't ask you to do anything that isn't simple. You know every answer. Notice that the word fear is bracketed along the difficulty, alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Here's your instruction for the fear inventory. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. Column 1, what do you fear, provided that there's no resentment in connection with them? Who or what do you fear? Column 2, we asked ourselves why we have them. Why do you have this fear? Column 3, in keeping with why we have them, what basic instincts are affected by this fear? Instinct or instincts are affected by this fear. Question. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Column 4. What did you do to set this fear in motion, and what character defects were brought to the surface that cause you to take or omit those actions. So the fear inventory, column one, who or what do you fear? Column two, why do you fear it? Column three, what basic instincts are affected by this fear? Column four, what's your part and what character defects were brought to the surface? Simple, easy, nothing complicated there. Nothing complicated there. You don't have to put down if you've ever told an ethnic joke. You don't have to put down if you've ever had sex with whatever, or what did you say, you've ever had sex with an animal or something? Did you ever ask a chicken why it crossed the road? Leave the chicken alone, and if it wants to cross the road, it's that chicken's business and not yours, and all this other stuff. I don't know what the questions are exactly, but they've got some crazy questions in that other Brown book, and I don't know what the heck they have to do with the fourth step, but I'm sure somebody must think that they have something to do with them because they're in there, but I don't exactly know why. Perhaps there is a better way, we think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite self. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? What a beautiful metaphor. It enables us to match calamity with serenity. Oh my God, I love it. We never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, He let Him demonstrate to us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be at once we commence to outgrow fear. Now, the third part of the inventory is the sex inventory. And when I did my first fourth step, I said to my then sponsor, I don't have to do this part. I've never been on a date. I thought I was going to get away with something here because I had never been on a date. So what he made me do is he made me go through my life to see where my relationships with friends was manipulative. Was there something other than what it was supposed to be? Was I trying to manipulate people? Was I trying to get something from people in using my God-given friendship charms for something other than what they were intended for? The sex inventory is an inventory of the harms that we do to one another in the sexual area. Now, there are very few ways that we hurt other people that are as deep as the sex area. It was May of 2010 when my then wife came in and told me she was dating and fell in love with a man from her office and that she demanded a divorce. It was very hurtful. Very hurtful. And these are some of the things that we do to hurt others. Now, before I begin this, I want to just give you my opinion. Not OA's opinion, not AA's opinion. I don't speak for OA, I don't speak for AA. And I do not speak for Bob and Bill in heaven, even though sometimes I think I do. God gave us the sex instinct so that we could reproduce ourselves. And He made it a very enjoyable thing so that we would enjoy it, provided that it's mutually assented upon and you're doing it with an adult that can say no. Simple. Right? If you're forcing yourself on a child, or you're forcing yourself on a person that's developmentally delayed, or you're forcing yourself on a handicapped person, somebody that can't say no, then we better look at that. But as long as it's two consenting adults, that's what we're talking about. And I don't care if it's man-man, man-woman, woman-woman, man-man, whatever, woman-man, I don't care. I am not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct, and I don't care about such things. That's why there's doors on bedrooms and doors on bathrooms. I don't care. I ask that when you go in the bathroom or the bedroom, close the door. What was that entertainer, Chuck Berry, I think, that had the film of the women in the bathroom? Don't want to see it. I like girls just as much as the next guy. Don't want to see what they do in the bathroom. No. Now, we need to ask ourselves, what did you do in the area of this sex thing that harmed and hurt another person that doesn't fall into the category of mutual enjoyment or reproduction or recreation, rather, of ourselves? Was there something that your sex partner wanted you to do that you should have given in a little bit more, maybe done for that person? Were there things you demanded that they do for you that maybe they didn't want to do and they kept telling you they don't want to do it, but you kept coercing them to do so for your own satisfaction, caring nothing for them? I am also of the belief, in keeping with the fact that I am not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct, but I am of the belief that I cannot be breaking the Ten Commandments while I'm working the 12 steps. I cannot be breaking the Ten Commandments while I'm working the 12 steps. It just doesn't work that way. Now, you don't have to take your clothes off to hurt somebody in this area of sex. Did you have a boss or a supervisor that you could tell was sexually attracted to you, that you cared nothing for them, but you led them on because you wanted to get a promotion, or you wanted to keep your job, or you wanted to make sure that your load at work was lighter? So you flirted with that person. So you let that person think that they had something going with you when in fact they didn't. I know of a man who bought lunch for a co-worker for 2 years. Every day he would buy her lunch. Now you might think that the she in this relationship was the perpetrator, but they weren't. Both were. The buyer of the lunches was trying to manipulate the woman, and the woman accepting the lunches was thinking, well, I can get a free lunch, so I don't have to spend my own money on lunch. These are some of the things we look at. Maybe you're using sex or withholding sex and withholding affection for a reason of maybe they're Democrats and you want them to be Republicans. So you'll show them, you'll withhold sex, you withhold information, or withhold affection until they come around to your way of thinking. Maybe they're Cubs fans and you want them to be White Sox fans. You'll show them. You'll cut them off at the pass until they come around to your way of thinking. Maybe you're sexually seducing someone that you care nothing for just to get even with another person. Maybe your sexual partner has a particular dislike for a certain person, so you have sex with them and carry on with them just to show them they're not going to screw with you. Maybe you're using sex to get attention. You want a fan club. You're just looking to put another notch on your belt. These are some, but not all, of the ways that we utilize this instinct for something other than what it was intended for. And these are the things we need to look at. These are the things we need to see in how we harm other people as we go through our lives attempting to satisfy our own instincts and get our jollies out of life. Who are we hurting in the process? Okay. Now about sex. I hope there's a demonstration later, but don't look at me. Many of us needed an overhaul in there, but above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes. Absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex. who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about that? Now, we're going to use a 5-column inventory for sex with a side assignment. Column 1, who did you hurt? This will always be a who, unless you're having sex with inanimate objects, but it's hard to hurt them. Column 2, what did you do or not do to hurt them? Column 3, what basic instincts are affected in this sexual harm done others? Column 4, what defects of character cause you to take or omit the actions in column 2? And column 5, what should you have done instead? Column 1, who did you hurt? Column 2, what did you do or not do? Column 3, what basic instinct is affected? Instincts are affected. Column 4, what should you have done instead? Okay. Did we review our own conduct through the years past? Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom have we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Did we do that one already? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it? Okay. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideas and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given, and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. So when he talks about the sexual ideal, I do not write down I want a brunette with this size kazoomer and that shape of a bottom. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is I learned from my divorce, I learned from my marriage, that very early on in my marriage, I made my wife my higher power. I learned in my marriage that that does not work. And when she was happy with me, the world was my little oyster. And when she was sad with me, the world was a very foreboding, horrible, dark, dangerous place. She became my higher power. She also became my mother. She was not my mate. She was not my wife. She was not my lover. She was not my date. She was my mother. She became my mom. And I feared her, but I never got the wife I wanted. I got the mom I wanted. And for 17 and a half years, she took very good care of me. She was the mother that I always felt I deserved and never got. When I was a little boy, I was my mother's husband and my father's wife. Now that I was married, I was going to get the mom I always wanted. And I would say probably for that reason and other reasons too, which didn't have much to do with me, I would say probably the last 10 years of that marriage were platonic. And even before then, sex was very, very, very difficult for us. We had a ton of sexual problems. We didn't touch each other much. If we touched, it was by mistake. And when we touched each other, we always said two words, excuse me. And the bottom line is that we tried to get pregnant one time, and we have a daughter. We tried to get pregnant once, and we were one for one. But I've learned that in my next relationship, if that's ever to happen, and I don't know that it will, and I don't know that it won't. I've never been a ladies' man. I've never had big success with ladies. I've admired them from a distance, but I've never had big success with them. I've learned, be the adult. And I get very jealous of these girls who have kissed a bunch of boys, and I haven't kissed a bunch of girls. And I get very intimidated because they've been in the arms of these guys that had time to practice their trade. And they've been in the arms of these guys that know how to please them, and know how to love them, and know how to make them happy. And I don't know those things. So for me, it's very intimidating because any gal that I'm going to look at dating is probably minimum 48, 49 years old. I'm 60. They've been around, and that's very scary to me. That's very intimidating to me, and I've got to let that go. And I don't know how to just go for it and let the chips fall where they may. I don't know how to pursue, and I don't know how to put myself out there sometimes. You know, some guys look at gals and they say, oh, I'm going to go after her. I look at a gal and if she's real good looking, I first assume I can't have her. I first assume there's no chance I'm going to get her, and that's in my way constantly. And these are things I have to work on, but I can't work on them unless I'm doing the steps. So my sexual ideal is to do the work necessary to overcome these things with God's help and through the steps. And the other thing I've learned above everything else is I don't have to marry the first girl that looks my way like I did the first time. I married the first girl that didn't say, Chubby, we need to talk. Tubby, you're misunderstanding. I just want to be friends. No, she wanted to get married. I was right there. She wants to get married. Count me in. And there were glaring problems with this relationship with my former wife right from the beginning. There were problems that probably indicated to me I never should have gone through with this. Only I ignored every one of them because, as my friend says, Harlan finally caught a fish and he wasn't going to throw it back. And I had a real good partner for my life, and I had a real good partner for my business, and a great mom for my daughter, but I didn't have the wife that I always wanted, and she didn't have the husband that she always wanted either. She deserves different, and I deserve different, whatever it is, I don't know, but we're not together anymore, and that's God's will, and that's the way it is, and we're divorced 4 years. I wish her nothing but the best. She was a queen, and she was wonderful, and she takes wonderful care of my daughter, and she and I built a business together, and we moved cross-country together twice, and she's a hell of a gal. She's a hell of a gal. She just doesn't want to be married to me. That doesn't mean she's a bad person. It just means she doesn't want to be married to me. I dusted myself off, I got back, and I said, okay, God, what's next? And these are the things that are my sexual ideal. And I can tell you this, I've had a lot of surgery over here, guys. A lot of surgery. And I was emasculated by this illness. Physically emasculated. I couldn't prove to you that I was a man, even if I stood before you naked. And I've had a lot of emasculization up in the brain. Because I looked at girls my whole life and just assumed that because I was tubby 2x4, can't get through the kitchen door, that there was no way they were going to look at me in that way. And what's funny is I wanted all the hot girls and I wanted all the gorgeous girls, never realizing they want the hot guys. And I what was I presenting? I was presenting to them a 500-pound body. I didn't have a pond to piss in or a window to throw it out of. What were they supposed to say? Come and ravage me, chubby? I mean, what are they supposed to say? You know, and I wanted all the hot ones. So I've learned a lot along the way. Okay, bottom of 69. Right? God alone can judge. And did I do the prayer, whatever our ideal turns out to be? Somebody's got to hold my feet to the fire here, guys. Come on.
God alone
can judge our sex situation. Counsel with, thank you, with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. There's that helping others thing again. This takes us out of ourselves and quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you have made a good beginning. This is not the end. This is a beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Now, it is 1 or 2 minutes or 10 minutes to 3. There's 2 time zones in this room. This is the Eastern time zone, I think, and that is the Western time zone, because this is earlier than this. But by my reckoning, it is really this time zone that is correct, because the cell phone never lies. The cell phone never lies. What is my schedule? Now, both Dave and Don are gone. What is our schedule? We're here till 3:15 or something? 3 o'clock.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. What, now, am I done for the day?
No.
We just did 9:30 tonight.
Oh.
All right. We're just getting started.
Okay. All right. So we're done, but very quickly, I'll take 2 questions. If there's 2 questions about step 3 or 4, I'll take them, and only 2 because I need a nap. What time is dinner, by the way? Let's talk about important things. I forget all the nonsense. What time is dinner? Is it 6? All right. Now that's information. Did everybody hear that?
Okay.
That's the information that we need. I'll take 2 questions on step 3 and 4. I must have done a hell of a job explaining it. Go ahead, Tom.
Do a 4-step when you went through divorce?
Yes, I did. I did a thorough 4-step when I went through the divorce. I did at that time, yes. And I actually did 2 of them. I couldn't make the amends because they wouldn't let me. To my daughter and my ex-daughter and my ex-wife, they wouldn't let me. But yes, I absolutely did. I absolutely did, yes.
Did it make you feel better?
It made me feel better. It didn't take everything away instantly, but it made me feel better. I had a sense I had done the right thing. And it was a huge step, yeah, definitely. But I'm still human. Mm-hmm.
May I ask how they didn't let you, what that was about?
I asked them if I could make amends to them for the harms I had done them, and they both declined.
Oh, I see.
You can't force someone to take your amends. You can't force someone to listen to you make your amends. They have the right to say, no, I'd rather not have that conversation. They have that right. I'm going to take a nap.